This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Everyone is going through something right now. We are in the first phase of a world-altering event. And even though part of the solution involves social distancing, we can still benefit from connecting to each other in different ways. We asked you to share how the coronavirus pandemic is changing your life, and you responded. Listeners from around the state have shared their COVID-19 stories with us, from canceled weddings and closed businesses to concerns about elderly neighbors and family. You've expressed fear and uncertainty about the months ahead. But you've also told us about how your communities are banding together and supporting one another. Today, we're going to check in with people all around the state and hear about what's on their hearts and minds in this unpredictable moment. Joining me to spend the hour and hear your stories are two wonderful guests. Kate Bowler is a professor at the Duke Divinity School. She's also the creator and the host of the podcast Everything Happens. Kate, welcome back to the show.
Oh, so glad to be with you.
Richard Watkins is also with us. He's a health expert and the CEO of the Science Policy Action Network, an organization dedicated to connecting the scientific community to the general public. Richard, welcome.
Good to be here.
So, Kate, you are immunocompromised, and you've been dealing with a whole range of life uncertainty for many, many years. So this reality that we're all facing right now is somewhat familiar to you. Take us into where your heart and mind is in this moment.
Ah, sure. Yeah, it's uncertainty accidentally became a way of life for me about 4 years ago when I was very unexpectedly diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. And I was in treatment for 2 years, and then since then have been on sort of team delicate, in which I have to be more careful than I would like. And the weird part about this as a state of being and a way of life is that it's opened me up to a whole world of people just like me who are living in precarity, that feeling that things can be given and taken away in a single moment. And so I think just what I was introduced to in that brief window is suddenly a part of everybody's daily life. And so we're seeing people try to experience and understand their own fragility in a culture that really prefers to narrate itself as invincible.
I want to bring in a guest now who very much has been living that experience. This is Alan Averbrook. He lives in Pinehurst, and he also is immunocompromised. Alan, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
So you heard Kate speaking about kind of living in this land of uncertainty. And for you, that meant deciding early to start complying with social distancing. So tell me about that choice and what that's been like for you.
Well, I mean, given my situation with the evolution of the coronavirus and what was going on, it's finally sort of clicked that I needed to distance myself probably a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, and canceled travel plans and sequentially canceled various social plans and slowly just isolated myself in my home. Essentially, my wife goes to work and she's been the one going to the market, and I'll step outside to walk the dog, but other than texting and emailing and phone, I've pretty much been on my own. It's a surreal kind of feeling.
You are a retired surgeon, so I'm wondering for you, this experience of, you know, feeling some fragility around your own health, but also being very aware of what's going on out there in the hospitals and people on the front lines. How are you making sense of those two realities right now?
Yeah. That's a complicated question, because it is a really scary time, and things are changing by the hour. New information coming in. There's a lot of different reactions, you know, from municipality to municipality, from state to state. The federal government has been pretty slow to respond and send out a message of concern and caution, and you know, so, and then it's just an unusual time. There's just a lot going on.
Many of us have been told to practice social distancing, which is a new phenomenon for many. Do you have advice to people who are new to this and don't really kind of can't really comprehend the meaning and significance? For as someone who is immunocompromised, what do you want those people to hear?
Well, I think everyone has to realize that, regardless of their health status, this is a risk, if not to them, to their neighbor, to the person down the street, to their best friends or people they don't know, to their grandmother, their grandfather, and they're equally as responsible to protect themselves from becoming infected, which could potentially put any of those people at risk, you know, as the next person. So we're all in this together, and there has to be a sense of connectedness and, you know, social responsibility. And that is a concern, because that doesn't seem to have been the case with a lot of people, particularly in the younger population. And there's actually more information coming out now that suggests that young people aren't going to be immune to this illness and are going to be at risk for significant problems if they become infected.
Alan Averbrook is a retired surgeon calling from Pinehurst. Alan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still with me are Kate Bowler, Duke Divinity Professor and the creator and host of the podcast Everything Happens, and Richard Watkins, the CEO of the Science Policy Action Network. Richard, you are a science communicator, and there are so many questions that people have right now, kind of an endless stream. But when we talk about this question of those who are more at risk and those who aren't, can you take us into that? Who should really be taking extra precautions right now?
Well, thank you. That's a really good question. And the previous caller touched on it a little bit. Everyone is at risk for infection. Now, as a community, we're still trying to figure out exactly what's going on with this virus. How does it spread? How long do symptoms last? Questions about immunity. These are all questions that we're still trying to answer. But to answer your question very specifically, very quickly, everyone is at risk for infection. And I just want to make that completely clear. From the very, very young to the very, very old, there's not any data that suggests that there are demographics who cannot be infected. From my current understanding of things, everyone is vulnerable to infections. And I guess at this point, I guess it's good to describe the difference between infections and confirmed cases. So it would be safe to argue that the number of infections is larger than the number of cases. So in order to have a case, you have to have a test confirm whether or not it's actually a COVID infection. And we don't at this point have the capacity to test everyone. So there are going to be people walking around who are harboring the virus, and they may not know it. So everyone is vulnerable to infection, and we don't know who's infected and who's not infected. Hopefully that's pretty clear.
Yeah, that's something important to keep in mind. All right, I want to go to another listener now. And this is a voicemail we actually got from one of our listeners about how COVID-19 is changing her life.
My name is Sandra. I live in Durham, North Carolina. I work in the arts, and I'm engaged to a physician who's training to be a pulmonologist at one of the hospitals here. Our life has been pretty seriously impacted by COVID-19. So I'm recording this the day after we sent an email out to all of our family and friends announcing the postponement of our wedding. We were supposed to get married at the end of April, and we're really devastated when we realize that the CDC's recommended 8 weeks of 50 groups or less included our wedding during that time period. So we're in the process of contacting all of our vendors, and it's quite stressful, it's quite disappointing, and it's just layered on the top of the stress that I know my partner is feeling as he is working on the ICU this month. So the ICU is ground zero for the preparedness and treatment of COVID-19, and I know so many people in our healthcare community are watching what is happening in Italy, and they are really hoping that they don't find themselves in the situation that so many of those doctors and nurses and staff do. We are both really dealing with a lot of uncertainty, and at this point in time, we don't know when to reschedule our wedding to, because we really don't know how all of this is going to pan out.
That's Sandra from Durham talking about how this coronavirus pandemic has impacted her. And we are spending this hour listening to your stories about how COVID-19 is changing things for you. I'm here with Duke Divinity Professor Kate Bowler and health expert Richard Watkins. And I only have about a minute until we need to take a break. But Kate, I would love to hear your reaction to Sandra's story.
Oh, that's so hard. Those big moments of both love and grief in which we want to be together. I had an elderly friend pass away this week, and we just had stories we were going to share at his funeral, just on behalf of his widow and his whole community who loved him. So it's these times of big togetherness that are perhaps the most painful, because we just can't duplicate them in isolation.
Yeah, and there's something about, you know, virtually sharing. You can't really virtually share a wedding celebration. That's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime.
Like launching people into the world and then closing out their lives. It just has to be done together.
Listeners around the state are joining us this hour to share their experiences. And with us now is Montserrat Coleman. She's a recent college grad living in Carrboro, but just a few months ago, she was in China working with the Peace Corps. Montserrat, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Tell me about your Peace Corps program and how you got evacuated from the country. That sounds like a whirlwind of an experience.
Yeah, it was. So our program was TEFL program, which is teaching English as a foreign language, specifically in colleges, just helping other students across the world, you know, learn more what would be called authentic English. So that's what we were doing.
And about 7 months in, you got evacuated, and now you're back home living with your parents. Is that right?
Yeah. So in January, we had what we called an in-service training. And that was mainly for us to get more training, be able to help each other out. And around the end of that month, 2 weeks later, we got told via email from our country director, hey, you're going to have to be evacuated because this has gotten too serious, and we're evacuating you to Thailand. So it was, and then from getting that email to leaving China, it was about 48 hours. So it was a really fast evacuation, for which I think the Peace Corps staff, specifically the China staff and the American staff that was over there, because they did everything, stayed up really late to help us get our flights out.
So you are with your parents in a one-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment, pretty tight quarters. What has that transition been like for you?
It has been, I would say, quite traumatic. My parents and I both live really different lifestyles. They work from home, so most of their time is spent at home working and mostly spending time with each other. I tend to spend more time outside of my house and, you know, talking with people, being very extroverted. So it is a little bit different, and, you know, but we're getting used to it. It's kind of weird, though.
Are you finding ways to make money now that your financial situation is different? You're not in the Peace Corps program anymore?
So I've started doing some freelancing Spanish translation jobs, which has helped a lot. And it's been it's nice because I can do it from home, especially during this time when we should be social distancing. It's a good way to earn money.
And how about your students in China? What are they saying about the pandemic? Have things blown over a little bit for them at this point?
Somewhat. All of my students have had to go to remote classes, which for them really sucks because they kind of don't get to spend time with each other anymore. They don't have that freedom they used to have. And also they've kind of lost really their foreign teachers, which were helping them a lot. So I kind of think they've kind of retreated a little bit back, and it's kind of sad, but, you know, unfortunately it's the reality.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. That's Montserrat Coleman calling from Carrboro.
Thank you.
Still with me are Kate Bowler, a Duke Divinity professor, and Richard Watkins, the CEO of the Science Policy Action Network. So, Richard, I have a question for you. We've been talking about this term social distancing a lot this hour, hearing people mentioning it. And I think what's coming up for people as we enter, you know, closing out week one, going into week two, maybe hearing this is going to go on for months. How far do we need to take social distancing? Should we be only seeing the people that live in our home? Is it okay to gather with a few friends? What are the parameters?
I mean, I think in regards – so first of all, social distancing is a general term. And in a nutshell, it basically means for as much as possible, stay in your home. You know, don't leave and – don't go and travel to places if you don't have to. And that's not just traveling across the country, internationally, for which for many of those cases there are travel restrictions, but it also means just don't go to places if you don't have to. I heard somebody mention gatherings of 50 or more people, but, you know, as of recently, they have now adjusted those guidelines to gatherings of over 10 people. And so these situations are changing dramatically. And I think, as your caller just said, people are going to find themselves in their homes, you know, trying to figure out things to do. But in a nutshell, social distancing is just staying away from each other. As far as the White House guidelines for the coronavirus, if you feel sick, stay at home. If someone in your house is sick, everyone should stay at home. And so really social distancing is exactly what it sounds like, you know, not engaging with other people. One, because we don't know who's infected.
Yeah.
And two, you could be infected and not know it yourself. And so, you know, we really shouldn't interact with people. And if you have to go to places, recognize that you need to put, you know, as much distance as you possibly can between you and another person. Some of the general guidelines state that it's 6 feet, and 6 feet, you know, should be appreciated.
Yeah. Kate, take us into your own family and how the social distancing is going for you. How are you staying sane? I know you have a young kid also.
Oh, man, the bubble. We are living in the bubble. Yeah, and I didn't ever picture myself as a sort of Little House on the Prairie style homeschooler, but here I am. I'll start making my own soups and skirts soon, I can tell. I think one of the first things we realized is that with a six-year-old, we needed structure, and then we also needed to have like a tight agreement about if anybody is in our lives, are they also alone? And so trying to figure out all the parameters around social distancing is like a series of hard conversations with friends and loved ones. So we're making sure we can keep our worlds as small as possible with as much love as possible.
Yeah. All right. We're going to bring in another caller now, and we are going to head out to the beach. We have a listener joining us from Elizabeth City. Hezekiah Brown is the host of a community talk show on WRVS. Hezekiah, welcome to the Seat of Things.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
So I know that Elizabeth City hasn't seen any confirmed cases yet. So tell me about, give me kind of a sense of the pulse in your neighborhood. How worried are you and your neighbors about what's going on?
Well, you know what? Frankly, I have to give you probably a personal perspective in terms of my philosophy. And that philosophy is, how do we turn a negative into a positive?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that everyone is experiencing something quite different in terms of this coronavirus. But on the other hand, we have to be able to say, how do we now turn this thing around? How can I utilize this time in a positive way? In Elizabeth City, you know, of course, you just mentioned we have not had any confirmed cases of the virus. And so we are working on the positive side, you know, working with the school district, we're working with the city government, the county government, the police department, and all of these things. We're working together. One of the things I say that it has happened is that this virus has really brought people together.
Yeah, give me some examples of that. Give me some examples of how you've seen the community respond.
Well, I've seen the community respond by virtue of the school lunch program. We had a great group of folks working together, and I stood back and just observed young people, old people, black people, white people, everybody working together and really enjoying working together. And you know what I said, maybe this crisis should come more often because it brings people together. We have people who are talking now that haven't talked for years, and I think it's because the crisis is here. But in the school district, I'm just amazed at how they are functioning in the school district. You know, they have adopted a philosophy in the school district of cooperation, communication, and collaboration. Our kids haven't lost one step in terms of schooling itself. You know,
well, how about the economic downturn? I'm curious to hear about that and kind of how restaurants and businesses are faring. Are there innovative ways to help keep them afloat?
Well, I think that the there are some struggles. I think there are some temporary struggles, because I say the only thing that's permanent is temporarily. And I think that people are surviving now. It hasn't really hit them because the only thing you can't get from the supermarket by and large now is toilet paper. But other than that, the food is in the supermarket, so people are being able to do that. Obviously, we have a lot of restaurants in Elizabeth City, and predominantly fast food restaurants. And what happened is that they're now surviving. They're not, many are not working. but they have also worked out situations where they can somewhat get paid.
Yeah. I know you have some interesting thoughts about how families can use this time to do some strategic planning. Tell me about that.
Absolutely. You know, strategic planning, strategic planning is something that people only think they can use on their job. Here's a prime time now to use strategic planning in a family setting. Not just by virtue of talking to your kids, because, you know, we're moving at such a fast pace in the world today until we think we're talking to our wives, we think we're talking to our children, but we really are not talking to them. We are talking at them. We're saying what the schedule is. But I'm just saying now to sit down with the family and say, where do we want to be 5 years from now? You know, is college involved? Is jobs involved? What's involved, traveling involved, vacations involved, but more than that, to sit down and talk to their children, you know, by virtue of saying to them, you know, how, just really, and being able to listen, how are things going? How are things going in school? Are you having any difficulties that we need to talk about? How is things going in your life? What are your plans for your life? Is there anything that you need help with? You know, just those 5 or 6 things there that you will be able to sit down in a comfortable setting at home and just discuss with your kids. But that does not only apply to your kids, it can apply to your husband, your wife, or anybody else. But this is how we make use of this time that we almost never, ever have along the way.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Hezekiah. That's the host of Around the Town with Hez Brown on WRVS in Elizabeth City. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Still with me are Richard Watkins, CEO of the Science Policy Action Network, and Kate Bowler, a Duke Divinity professor and creator and host of the podcast Everything Happens. So, Kate, we heard about some of these ways that communities are coming together. Can you talk about the way you've seen faith communities in particular adapt to what's been going on?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, this Sunday, it was, one of the things I write about a lot is mega churches. And it was interesting watching the largest churches mobilize platforms they'd already developed to figure out, like, what does togetherness look like other than just, I mean, there's broadcasting the sermon, but, like, beyond that, how do people feel connected? So I've watched some really beautiful attempts to host, like, Facebook Live and Zoom and all kinds of ways to get people to be able to interact with each other, to kind of virtually lay hands on each other, even if we're in isolation. Because I'd had a chance to talk to Vivek Murthy a couple months ago about what loneliness feels like. And he said, well, people think you need all kinds of people to be there for you, but really you just need your three. You need three friends to feel like you're not actually alone in the world. And so often faith communities can help us figure out our three and just have enough people check in on each other, not just on Sunday mornings, but throughout the week to make sure that people have enough to get by.
Yeah. Well, we're hearing your COVID-19 stories this whole hour. My buddies and with me to hear your stories are Duke Divinity Professor Kate Bowler and health expert Richard Watkins. And we are going to go now to Wilmington, where we're going to learn a bit about how the coronavirus is reshaping our entire economy and really hitting home for small businesses in North Carolina. Caroline Fisher is joining us now. She's a small business owner in Wilmington. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Hi, Anita. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Tell us about how COVID has impacted your business, COVID-19, and what's been going on for y'all.
So my business, Swahili Coast, is a small brand that sells ethically made accessories from East Africa, and we also own a couple of retail stores here in Wilmington. We made the hard decision on Sunday that would be our last day open in our retail stores as social distancing efforts really heated up. And so we went ahead and closed our doors there. And our wholesale business, which is the bulk of our business, has also dried up because all of our partners are also small businesses who are closing. So it's been a rapid change.
What kinds of conversations are you having with your employees and internally? I mean, how do you even begin to prepare when the future is really uncertain?
That is the hardest part, to be honest. And we have been doing everything that we can to be really transparent with our employees. Just yesterday, I sent out all of the details as far as filing for unemployment through the state of North Carolina, which you don't have to be fired to do. You can just have your hours cut and there's no waiting period now. And it's just a hard call because we just don't have any answers right now for our employees.
Have you heard anything from state or local government that makes you feel optimistic about support you may get moving forward?
I feel optimistic that there are efforts underway, but we certainly haven't seen any concrete efforts to assist small business owners as of yet. There's certainly talk of opening additional loan opportunities and things along those lines, but I will say small business owners are in a bit of a crunch right now. We are also folks who are not eligible for unemployment. So I do know that there are a number of folks who are small business owners, who are self-employed, who are in the gig economy, who these efforts to help individuals with unemployment really don't assist us.
Are there ways that people in your community and around the state can help you and help other small businesses? What are your recommendations?
Absolutely. There have been huge efforts here in Wilmington and all around the state that I've seen to adapt our businesses to continue to serve our communities and continue to bring in whatever business we can. For us, we've moved a lot of our business online, and so we're still hoping to be able to give hours to our employees to fulfill orders. And I know a lot of other local businesses have done that as well. And restaurants are doing a lot of carryout and delivery service, and our restaurants give a third of our nation's meals. And so we really need to continue to support restaurants as long as they're following safe practices, because our food systems also aren't developed enough to handle 50% more demand.
Yeah, of course. Well, Caroline, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. She's the co-founder and creative director of Swahili Coast, a small business in Wilmington. Thanks, Caroline.
Thanks, Anita.
Still with me are Kate Bowler and Richard Watkins. And Richard, I want to turn to you for what I'm afraid is the million-dollar question that is on everyone's minds, but do we know how long this is going to last? Do we have any good estimates at this point? Anything you can provide on that front?
No, we don't know how long this will last. Whether you're looking at the social implications, the economic implications, or just the epidemiology, you know, how this virus is going to spread through our societies, we don't know how long this is going to last. I wish I had better news, but quite frankly, I've never seen anything like this before, and I'm not sure anyone has. So I don't know how long this will last.
Kate, we'll get to this a little bit more, but just a kind of a minute worth of your thoughts on, if we don't know how long this is going to last, what can we do right now on a daily basis? What can we integrate into our routines to manage the uncertainty?
Yeah, our poor brains, right? I mean, we're just constantly, I find that one of the easiest ways for me when I'm dealing with a lot of fear is having like a daytime routine and a nighttime routine. Like daytime is for doing the hard work, giving the gift, learning all the news, being the best self. And then nighttime, you pick a time every day and shut it down. Give yourself time to adjust to the new reality, reset. You can do it again tomorrow.
As the anxiety of quarantine and social distancing builds, it's worth hearing from folks who've been through the process. Cary resident Nianchan Liu joins me. His wife recently came out of 2 weeks of quarantine, and he has many lessons we can all learn from. Hi, Nianchan.
Hi.
So your wife was in quarantine for 2 weeks. You all were separated from her as a family. How did you support her from afar? What can we learn from how to best do that?
Yeah, I think at the time it was just her getting quarantined and we were still free out there. So that was easier. And all I did it was just to stock up some food for her. And while she was quarantined, I was still able to buy groceries for her and then drop at the door and she would just took them in by herself. And that was from material side. But I think more importantly, it was the emotional side. On the second day she was quarantined, she started feel she was so isolated, she was so bored, and she felt like desperately needs friendship and people contact. So the way we did was to call her, or also we have a WeChat that Chinese people like to use, and then we can just do the video call through WeChat. And also, my younger son, who goes to the elementary school, I still drop him at the bus stop, which is very close to our house. And every morning, I would drive my son to our house, just stop by there, and we'll wave to each other through the windows.
Oh, that's sweet.
To each other on the phone at the same time. Yeah, it's so sad that you can see each other, but you just can't touch each other, you know, just cannot hug each other. So it was a very emotional moment at that time. But luckily, we knew that it was only for 2 weeks she would be quarantined. So and we were pretty sure that she would not have the virus. And luckily that she didn't have it. So that was good.
So she was taking precautions because she had been visiting family abroad. So she came back and self-quarantined to make sure she didn't pass anything along. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So she had 2 weeks quarantine. That's why we were quite hopeful. We knew that it would be over in 2 weeks. But in this situation right now, those two hosts were saying that we didn't know or we don't know how long that's going to last. And also at this time, we don't know who around you carries virus.
Yeah.
So that makes the situation much worse.
Do you have any strategies for keeping kids positive, keeping the morale up during potentially quarantine from family members or distancing in general?
Yeah, before my wife came back, we told them that we have to be separated from her, but it will be temporary. So even in this situation, we don't know how long it will last, but I think we're hopeful that it will be over. Even when we look at China's situation right now, that the new cases there through their restrictions, that the situation has improved significantly. So I would encourage them to say, yeah, even though they are off from school right now, they may feel bored at home, that we can still have family time together. And also, I just tell them that, you know, it will be over sometime. We don't know how long, but eventually it will be over. There's a hope.
Keeping the hope. Well, thank you so much for joining us to share your story. Yanshen Liu joined us from Cary. Thank you, Yanshen.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And you can join our conversation on Twitter throughout this hour, joining using the hashtag coronavirusNC. Still with me are Kate Bowler and Richard Watkins, our guests this hour. So, Richard, we know people are traveling to be with their families now. We know dorms are closing. Some people are kind of evacuating where they are to go home. Are the precautions that people should take after traveling to make sure that they are keeping those that they love safe, or for those people who still have to go to work and who are coming back home to family, what can they do to make sure they're not passing anything along?
Yeah, I would say that there are some people who have to travel, and it's really important for them to travel because they keep our society and our communities going, especially providing necessary goods and services. And to those people, I have to say thank you for what you're doing. The first thing that I would tell anyone to do that has to be around other people while they're, you know, providing those goods and services is to monitor their own health. The CDC has guidelines of things that you should watch out for. Symptoms can appear between 2 and 14 days post-exposure. So you basically have a two-week window to be looking out for. You have fever, trouble breathing, coughing, a productive cough, and those things do not get better or they get worse. Those are some of the reasons why you want to call your medical provider as soon as possible. And then when you start seeing those symptoms, once you are in your house with your family members, it's going to be really important that you try to isolate yourself in a room if you have that opportunity. I know some people's living situation is close quarters. So for those people, that's going to be difficult to do. But if you do have the space available in your home, try to be in your bedroom and have family members in your house bring you food and so on and so forth until you start feeling better, or until you have to call, you know, a medical provider and go in for treatment. And if you're going in for treatment for other things and you tell your medical provider that I think I have symptoms of COVID-19 so that they can prepare themselves.
Yeah. That's good advice.
I might have left something off.
Okay. No, that's good advice. We got a text from someone named Josh in Hillsborough who works at a grocery store, and I think a lot of those suggestions would be really relevant to his situation. One more note that we got is from someone who is 31 weeks pregnant, being really cautious, navigating a lot through childcare, a new job, and pregnancy, but really wondering about how pregnancy impacts her susceptibility. Do we know much about that at this stage?
So we don't know how much pregnancy impacts or puts you at more risk. I don't know that. That information may be available due to the fact that the immune system changes a little bit during pregnancy, but I don't know if that makes you more or less vulnerable to severe disease outcomes. Everyone's at risk for infection, but as far as higher risk for severe disease outcomes, I am not sure of that. But I would advise caution for anyone, especially women who are pregnant.
Okay. I want to go to the mountains now to someone named Stephen Goldstein, who is joining us. He is a retiree living out in Asheville. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. Tell me about Asheville right now. I know you often spend a lot of time walking around the Biltmore, walking around downtown, and things are feeling really different out there.
It's very different. At this time of year, Asheville is usually coming out of its slow period in terms of tourism. I mean, there's never a dead time here anymore, but usually from New Year's to about the middle of March, things are quieter, and then around this time, it gets very, very busy. And my observation is that there is just nobody here. I was downtown yesterday with an errand that I had to run, and it was like being in a ghost town. There were very, very few people on the streets, almost no cars. A parking garage that normally I would try to get into that might have 10 available spaces had almost 200 spaces available. I mean, it's that sort of thing. And Biltmore is largely shut down. The outdoor activities, fortunately, are still available, so the hiking that I do over there and on some of the mountain trails here is still available to me, and it seems to be relatively safe.
Yeah.
But again, there are practically no people.
You are retired, and you have been for a little while, and I know you are feeling concerned about your finances. I know a lot of us have been told, do not look at your retirement account, just ride this wave out. But for people who are actively living off of that income and really relying on it, this is such an uncertain time. So what has that experience been like for you financially?
That's the most threatening aspect of this to me. Almost everything you hear on the news coming out of the federal government in terms of proposals for various bailouts has no benefit whatsoever for people who live off of interest and dividend income. My personal situation is that, yes, I have been retired for going on 16 years and have an investment portfolio that's structured to keep me afloat. I am less concerned with the precipitous drop in value, but that reflects that these companies that pay these dividends are probably going to suffer extremely severe losses of income. And what will happen if they lose income, they will cut dividends, which the prospect of having my income cut in half, which certainly one believes the valuation that the market is putting on itself, that's what we'd be looking at. That's very scary, and I honestly don't have an answer for anyone who asks me, you know, what do you plan to do about it?
Mm. And you also rent a home to people who play in a touring band. I know Asheville is home to a lot of musicians.
Yeah.
What have your conversations been like with them, and how is this changing their financial situation?
I actually haven't talked to them. I have a property manager who deals with them directly, and we're sort of avoiding the issue. I mean, at this point, they are not delinquent on the rent, so I'm hoping that things will stay stable. But I have to recognize that since they earn their income from touring, and needless to say, there's no place for them to tour at this point. Everything is pretty much closed nationwide where they might be performing. My assumption is that their income will be precipitously cut as well, and that may result in their either having to default on the lease or ask for some sort of reduction, which, again, puts pressure on me.
Yeah. Well, lots of uncertainty. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Stephen Goldstein calling from Asheville. Thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome.
Still with me are Kate Bowler, a Duke Divinity professor and the creator and host of the podcast Everything Happens, and Richard Watkins, CEO of the Science Policy Action Network, an organization dedicated to connecting the scientific community to the general public. So, Kate, we've heard so many different stories this hour from all around the state. What have you heard in these stories? What are some threads that are really sticking with you?
Oh, well, there's just so much uncertainty, and there's so much fear in uncertainty, especially because culturally speaking, there are not that many sort of sustaining public accounts that we have of people who are allowed to fail without feeling like failures.
Hmm.
The prevailing ethos is all self-help. It's all bootstraps. It's all you can do it. You can help. No, seriously, I hope you enjoy your time by yourself. and the problem is it's always had this binary between winners and losers. And a time like this where there is absolutely no good individualistic reason why some people suffer and some do not, I hope we're going to see a sort of a tide turn about the way that people explain the suffering of others, that we hear more compassion in each other's voices, a deeper desire to understand the systemic cause behind people's problems rather than constantly rush to evaluate who deserves what.
Hmm. Richard, I know we've been turning to you this hour for your health expertise, but I want to turn to you just kind of human to human for a second and hear what struck you this hour. I mean, and so many people with so many varying questions and experiences.
I think what Kate was just saying, you know, although I am a scientist, I'm a human being, and I love my community, I love my family, and I love my friends. And to basically be faced with the realization that the things that we took for granted, like the ability to say hello to somebody, the ability to shake hands, to hug one another, it really hits home when you're sitting at home and, you know, you've done with the work that you have for that day as you're working from home, and you turn on the television and, you know, you're done watching the news because you've been watching the news, you know, hour in, hour out, and you decide to just watch a movie or something or a television show. And then you just see people just doing things that, oh, wait, that's not our reality anymore. Mm. You see people at a party. You see people having a good time. You see a concert. And then you're just like, oh, that's not our reality. And there's absolutely not that many forms of entertainment that currently reflect what you are experiencing. And here's the other thing that really strikes me as a dad, as a husband, somebody who shares what you just said, Kate, staying at home, trying to figure out how to be a homeschool teacher and working from home. When you do make those trips out of your, you know, house and you go to the grocery store and you can overhear people's conversations and everyone is talking about the exact same thing, and you realize that those conversations are not just taking place at your local grocery store, but globally, that every single person is having the same conversation, that is an experience and a realization that I don't think I was prepared to, you know, stumble across.
Yeah. Kate, we only have about a minute left, but do you have kind of any anything you want to leave us as kind of a meditation or a phrase or something to kind of return to amidst all of this uncertainty that you might be able to offer?
Well, I guess one thing that I sort of rest on is we know that not everything is possible anymore, and we know we don't want to be pessimists and say that nothing is possible. But if we just try to find ourselves in the question, what is possible today? We would do the best we can. We love everyone we can. And then we try again tomorrow.
Kate Bowler, a Duke Divinity professor and the creator and host of the podcast Everything Happens. Richard Watkins was also with us, CEO of the Science Policy Action Network, an organization dedicated to connecting the scientific community to the general public. Thank you so much to both of you.
So glad to be here. Thanks.
And thank you to all of our listeners for opening their hearts to us this hour. You can keep this conversation going on Twitter with the hashtag coronavirusNC. You can also share your story with a message to our new voicemail number. That number is 919-980-5419. We are checking that inbox regularly throughout this crisis. Again, 919-980-5419. The State of Things is produced by Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon, and Lindsay Foster-Thomas. Josie Taris also produced today's show, and she is our intern. Jenny Lawson is the technical director. We had help today from Al Widarski. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.